Welcome to Pemba On Demand. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. I am very excited to welcome you to our podcast. Pemba On Demand is produced for physicians interested in professional development. We will be discussing a wide range of topics on the podcast. I will be interviewing physician leaders from the U.S. and from other countries who have graduated from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. These physicians will be sharing stories of professional and personal growth, overcoming challenges in their organizations, and discussing key leadership skills they have learned from the MBA program and ongoing professional development. I'm pleased to introduce as our guest today Dr. Michael Fromke. Michael is a fellow Pemba alumnus, graduating in 2022 from Pemba. He is also a neurosurgeon practicing at Lee Health in Florida. In addition to practicing neurosurgery, he also has a physician executive role in the organization and is a member of the Lee Professional Group. Michael, welcome to Pemba On Demand Livestream.
Thank you, Norm. Thanks for having me, and thanks for everyone signing on, and hopefully this will be a meaningful session.
Well, I think this is going to be a great session. I always get excited as I plan for these and as you and I have had a chance to meet and discuss the work that you've been doing at Lee Health. Before we begin to discuss the improvement project that you're going to be sharing with us today, talk a little bit with us about some of your thoughts regarding your MBA. I know you graduated from Pemba back in 2022, just a couple of short years ago, actually not even quite 2 years since we graduated at the end of the year. But I was wondering if you would mind sharing with our audience a little bit about your experience during Pemba and what maybe your motivation was for enrolling in the MBA program.
Sure. Thanks, Norm. Yeah, so in 2021, I was assistant medical director for neurosciences at Lee Health, and I felt like I was always behind in the meetings. I didn't understand the nomenclature, some of the rhetoric. And as much as I thought I knew that it would be helpful to go ahead and get the MBA. I was familiar with the UT's Pemba program because I practiced in Knoxville for many years. During my private practice there, I actually considered doing this in the early 2000s, but I was raising four children. I just didn't have the time. But after my children went off to UT, I found that the field of medicine was changing quickly, and I shut down my private practice and went on a search for a suitable employer. I ended up at the University of North Carolina on faculty there, where I worked. My chairman was the head of quality for UNC, and he was a good mentor. And that's when I really knew I would probably seek an MBA. I actually looked at North Carolina, but it was 2 years and too expensive, really. And then when I came to Florida, I had a unique opportunity. My direct at the time actually thought it was a great idea, and the Pemba was perfect because it was just 1 year. It was quite intensive, but my job at the time allowed me to do it. And so I applied, and the rest is history.
So you mentioned that you already had a leadership role in the organization prior to you starting in the Pemba program. How long had you been in leadership roles before you decided that it would be the right time for you?
Well, I was pivoting towards that while I was at Chapel Hill. And I'd been elected to the faculty board by my peers before I came here. Lee Health reached out to me. They were in crisis. And they just needed some coverage. I came down there and helped them out for 2 weeks over the holidays. And that kind of started a relationship. And when I came here, I was brought here to kind of resurrect their neurosciences, so to speak. And I was positioned with a dyad partner. I took on the role almost immediately as system medical director over the neurosciences, which encompassed several different areas. And I was partnered with my dyad partner, Cindy Drapel, who is a guru in everything stroke. So she was system director, I was system medical director, and then we administrated, if you will, the various service lines trying to build an institute model. We'll get into more of that during the talk.
Great.
That's really, I was kind of thrust into that role, and there's a lot of learning, you know, learning by the seat of your pants, so to speak. But I really didn't realize how agnostic I was towards some of these leadership skills I need until I got into Pemba, particularly in the professional development part of it and leadership. That's part of the program. So that, that was very instrumental in my development.
So that leads me into kind of my next question. I like to ask everybody who completes an MBA, we all have sort of expectations of what we're going to get out of it. But what was the thing that you least anticipated that proved to be of the most benefit to you as you went through the program?
I think what I did not anticipate was how quickly things change on you and how, as a leader, you got to be able to adapt to those changes on the fly sometimes real quick and keep your team moving forward. In the midst of my MBA, for example, our system underwent a complete radical leadership change. Mm-hmm. Things were restructured and people were shuffled around and moved around and system priorities changed because we were coming out of COVID at that time. And COVID changed a lot, particularly for our health system. We also had a Category 5 hurricane hit us in September of my Pemba year here, which completely wiped out Fort Myers and was quite challenging. But you learn how to accept those changes that come up on you, things you can't control, and you adapt, you learn, and that's what really tests your leadership skills. I've benefited from that quite a bit.
Thank you for sharing that. As I look back at my Pemba experience from back in 2008, I have a lot of fond memories. I wonder if you would mind sharing what your favorite memory of Pemba is.
I guess my favorite memory was the boot camp I went to, and I met so many new friends there, and I developed some key relationships. And then the first week of my RP1, just how intensive it was, is like, I think the words that were used were, we're going to force feed you with a fire hydrant, water hose, and we're going to immerse you in this. And Bruce Benn was our accounting professor, and Dr. Daves was our finance. And I tell you, it was a little intimidating, but getting through that first RP1, it's a very memorable. And I just remember how excited I was to come back for the subsequent RP sessions. And by the end of the year, I was sad that it was over, actually, because
yes,
we had made so many good friendships, not with just our fellow classmates, but our cohort. My cohort was superb. We still maintain relationships to this day. And then so many of the faculty developed great relationships with. So it's just a truly enhancing experience for that 12 months.
Well, thank you for taking a little time at the beginning of the show to share your thoughts on the value that you got from Pemba and brought back memories listening to your memories. So that was a great time. So I'm really excited that we're having the opportunity to learn about your efforts at Lee Health and how you've taken some of the lessons that you've learned. And I know that this was your OAP for your Pemba program, but interested in supply chain restructure, cost efficiency, and standardization is always, it seems like, a huge priority for organizations. And I'm really excited to learn about the impact that this had on patients, the surgeons, the other staff, as well as your organization. So sure. Without further ado, I will turn it over to you.
Okay. Well, thanks, everybody. I think before I get started, I'll kind of give you a brief outline here. We'll start with a little bit of history about who I work for, some of the background about why we did what we eventually went through. And then we'll go into some of the nitty-gritty on how we did it, and then we'll finish up with where we are today and what the results were. So I work for a public health care system here in Southwest Florida. We are the largest health system here. We're basically the biggest healthcare system in our 5-county area. We serve a population of about 1.38 million in our 5 surrounding counties. And we have enabling legislation that requires us to take care of the residents of Lee County, regardless of their ability to pay. So we're very good at what we do. We've never taken one penny from the taxpayers. They've tried that tax initiative, but it never gets through. So it really requires that we're good stewards of the resources that we're given. We're in a very high population growth area. We're projected to hit 1.5 million lives here in 2030. We have 4 adult acute care facilities and 1 pediatric. Our flagship hospital is now Gulf Coast Medical Center, which has one of our certified comprehensive stroke centers. 2 of our other facilities are certified primary stroke centers. And we, at the time of when I was system medical director, we were the only certified stroke center between Miami and Sarasota. So everything pretty much came to us. Now we've had a more recent one develop in Naples, which has decompressed us a little bit. In terms of trauma, we're very active. We function like a level 1, but we're technically a level 2 because we're not a teaching hospital. And we are the only certified trauma center between Miami and Tampa General. So we are very heavy intensive on that. We have 4 strategic pillars, if you will, where we concentrate our efforts based on our community needs. And those are our front door primary care, our oncology division, our orthopedics, and then our cardiovascular institute. And those are four of our strategic areas that our senior leadership focuses on. I came here in 2018, kind of at a moment in crisis. I was on faculty at Chapel Hill at the time, and I got an urgent call. I knew one of the neurosurgeons down here. Their neurosurgery program had severe turnover. They were just down to three neurosurgeons. They only had one neurologist left. Everything was being run by a service line model. And there was just a lot of fragmentation and just a lot of disarray, if you will. And I came down here and gave them a couple of weeks of my time to help decompress their neurosurgeons. One of them is a personal friend of mine, and developed a relationship. And they asked if I would be interested in coming on board. And I said, well, this is what I really want to do is build a program. And so eventually I matriculated here over the next few months and took on the role of system medical director. We have a dyad leadership model here, and I was paired with a dyad system director. Her name was Cindy Drapel at the time. She's a guru in everything stroke. And we started this process towards building a neuroscience institute. And we were given the administrative reins over neurology, neurosurgery, pain management, physical medicine and rehab, our neuro intervention, catheter work, if you will, for stroke, a neuropsych program, and our sleep labs. It entailed not just employed neurosurgeons. Lee Physician Group is our employed group, which has over 1,000 employed providers. But we also, under our institute model, have private practice groups, including neurosurgery and a very large neurology group that was private. And at the time that I came in, there were numerous professional service agreement contracts that we had that were quite expensive. We also had a neurodiagnostics lab with EEG, EMG, nerve conduction study. And when I came here, my pet project at Chapel Hill was the emerging technology of neurosurgical robots. That was one thing I wanted to bring in too. So those first 2 years, we were ramping up the robotics and building everything out. And then COVID hit in 2020. And, you know, this is one of those things that we talked about earlier about how you have to change rapidly on the go. And in 2020, thankfully, we were, much of what we do is tier three type work in Medicare. So it didn't really slow neurosurgery down in terms of stroke and trauma, brain tumors, things like that. And a lot of the neurological diseases too were important to continue on. So we were still quite active and able to actually generate some revenue, but we were fortunate and we started getting phone calls, and we were trying to build up our ambulatory neurology department. And We started receiving phone calls from neurologists had been laid off because of COVID. And this was like a goldmine to us. We were able to, in the year of COVID 2020, build out our own LPG neurohospitalist program to cover all four of our adult hospitals and our stroke centers. In addition, we fully staffed ambulatory neurology with four general neurologists. We made a key strategic change in our NI lab. We canceled a PSA agreement with an interventional radiologist that was doing our catheter work. And we went over to strictly neurosurgeons with board certification in endovascular and cranial treatment. Because we were losing patients. Our interventionalists would transfer surgical cases over to Miami. And we wanted to keep that. So that was a key move in the development of this program. We were able to cancel all of our PSA agreements. We turned the private neurology group literally held a gun to our head and would say, you're going to pay us this. We were paying them over $1 million a year to cover our hospitals and our emergency rooms. And we subsidized their charity care to Medicare levels, including Medicaid. So we were paying them $1 million and they were also collecting 2.5. We were able to flip that over. And now we have a fully hospital-employed neurohospitalist program. We have fully staffed ambulatory neurology, three neurosurgeons now in our NI labs. And it allowed us to start recruiting specialists in the area of functional neurosurgery, movement disorders, and epilepsy, which were all important services that our our community needs assessment found that we need to pay attention to. Next slide, please. Norm, can you flip over? There we go. During this time, also in late 2020, early 21, we were approached by some of our VPs that were managing our ACO and our managed care products. And Lee Health has been very active in participating in some of these BPSI shared savings and bundled payments. And we were asked to consider getting into alternative payments, particularly bundled payments, for our stroke program, our epilepsy and spine surgery, as it would relate to an episode of care. And so we started taking a look at that, and we were actually surprised. We were well below our target pricing in the management of our epilepsy. We could have easily done that. We were very close to our target pricing in stroke. We were probably $400 over our per episode of care in stroke, but our spine surgery, our elective spine surgery, was disastrous. We were $3,000 above target pricing. And at that time, we really thought variation, particularly in the spine area, was contributing to that. As it turns out, it's really what happens in that post-acute care, that after they leave the hospital, that kills you. And if you want to blow a bundle, you just have one of your patients come back to the emergency room. And by the time they get there, the cost of care there is so exorbitant that you can quickly spend a lot of money and lose out. So we opted not to do that, but it did provide the impetus for us to really focus in a little bit on stroke and our rehab capabilities, and then take a closer look at our spine situation and see where we can make improvements. Another thing that hit us coming out of COVID, I'm sure many of you are aware, is the need for what I call termed a lot of disruptive innovation. Our healthcare system initiated an accelerated path to value transformation. And this is much along the lines, you think back 20, 25 years ago, digital revolution, the digital transformation that took place in healthcare systems. Our healthcare system was now ready to really position itself in some of these value-based care programs. So our system experienced a significant change in the structure of its senior leadership. We had significant turnover in the C-suite, and senior levels and mid-levels of leadership were redesigned. The innovation was aligned along kind of a rephrasing. No longer did we speak of our outpatient clinics, primary care, and specialty clinics. Those are now our community care platforms. Our inpatient services became acute care, and then our ambulatory and rehabilitation became wellness and recovery platforms. And these leadership changes were put in place so that we could make incremental changes in the infrastructure of our system that would position us to be successful in future value-based care initiatives. And we had to do this at the same time as we had to drive those fee-for-service engines that actually provide the revenue for us to be successful. So I started my MBA, and I kind of knew at the end of 2021, we could probably choose an OAP project looking on spine. So we focused in on spine surgeries that were performed here at Lee Health to align our program for the emerging value-based payment models that were coming out. We wanted to develop some standardization by eliminating waste and variation in three key areas. That would be cost reduction, improving our operational efficiencies, and optimizing the patient experiences. As you know, value in healthcare is traditionally defined by the equation of your quality divided by cost. But now, when you look at what's emerging from CMS and Medicare, there's an infusion of diversity, equity, and inclusion that's so important in moving the needle in population health. And are we really improving the health of the community that we serve as a population as a whole? And so if we're going to really be getting into some of these value care packages that we're going to offer our community, we need to make sure that we're doing the right things. And so that's really the basis of what we're going to do here. Our objectives on our spine spend was to reduce variable and spinal implant costs in our elective surgeries. And vendor reduction was going to be a key element of this process of our objectives. We also needed to improve our OR efficiencies. And then, of course, for the value, we wanted to improve the patient experience. Next slide. The first thing we did was find out where we were. And so we just contacted our OR directors. We went into our Slicer Dicer programs in Epic, and we just did a quick survey to see where we were. This is very raw data. This is the first data that we kind of found of where we stood. We were spending around $10.8 million on spine cases at Lee Health. And we operate with a GPO called Cooperative Services of South Florida. And we found at that time our GPO was just below the industry. We were slightly below 50 percentile in terms of our pricing structure. We found 25 spinal supply and implant vendors through our Epic system. But interestingly, the top 10 were about 84%, or about $9 million of the spend. And over two-thirds of our spending belonged to the top six vendors at about $7 million. We thought that we could look at this and maybe through standardization and restructuring of some contracts, we could maybe make a savings of 13 to 24% and maybe save the system up to $2.6 million. This is our first overlook. This is what really kicked us off and going. So my role had shifted, it was shifting more over into value analysis. And I started working as the physician executive on the value analysis with my dyad there, the system director, Cora Murphy. And we knew we needed to get this vendor reduction program off and running because we wanted to use vendor reduction and leverage that to renegotiate contracts for pricing. We also knew that if we're going to go to 20 spine surgeons and ask them to do something like this, we needed to have data. So we have a very robust analytics center of excellence here, and we asked them to collect some data for the trailing 12 months and then run trend analysis on current fiscal year to date and prior fiscal year to date, and to show us what that data looked like. And this included identifying the number of surgeons, the number of vendors, the surgical spine procedures that were being performed at each acute facility. After we obtained that data, we then filtered it and we looked for some key performance indicators. And so some of the things that the initial filter came out and some of the layers of granularity, if you will, were the implant cost per case, the variable cost per case, the total cost, length of surgery, length of stay data, canceled cases and intraoperative delays. 30-day readmissions is very important to our institution. We wanted to see where we stood on that. Because of our desire to really get more into the risk market, we wanted to look at case mix index and see if we could pull some key correlations out there. And finally, of course, this is always important to us, the chief financial officer, but the contribution margins. Now, this is an example of the first data that we pulled out. And what this slide is kind of busy, and I apologize, but this identified, we thought we had 25, but we found 31 vendors operating in our system with 20 spine surgeons. You'll see that number at the very bottom there, and an annual spend of a little over $11 million. And we were able to break each of the vendors down into their market share within our system. So you'll see Medtronic, of course, is number one, followed by NuVasive. What was then Zimmer Biomet, which their spine division now has been spun off, something called ZimV, much smaller. Stryker, of course, is big, and so forth. Again, I apologize for the busyness of this slide, but this kind of goes to show how we drill down the data. And this is looking at the hardware. And what this slide demonstrates is that bone screws and something called the interbody spacer are by far the two of the biggest components that we were implanting. And that accounted for a vast majority of our spine spend. These would be pedicle screws or screws that you use to put a plate on the spine. An interbody spacer is a device that's put between two vertebral bodies. So it could be in the disc space, or let's suppose you removed a whole vertebral body and then it would span three vertebral segments like a corpectomy spacer. These are very expensive devices. But this kind of gave us an idea of where the money was going. And by far, it was on the screws and the implants, not so much the rods. We were able to even drill down into the bone screws, and we could say, okay, well, how much are we purchasing from each vendor? And then we could look to see where we were, and we could benchmark that against the national market share. So on the left side of this slide, you'll see Medtronic and Stryker, Spinewave, Catalyst, Globus, and Invasive were our top five vendors for supplying pedicle screws and other bone screws. And you can see how our spend compares to the national market share. Of course, Medtronic is a big player. Interestingly, NuVasive and Globus Medical actually purchased NuVasive, and they are right on the heels now of Medtronic. This is data from 2022. We also looked at the spend per surgeon. And the thing I like about this slide is on the right side, it's broken down into the surgeon's use of pedicle screws and the surgeon's use of interbody spacers. On the left side, you can see the number of surgeries they do, their total spot charges, and their costs per case. And this data we shared with surgeons individually, but we blacked out their competitors' names. They could see where they stood. What I like about this slide is we saw right away some of the surgeons that were using a high number of spine vendors. Some were using 10 different vendors for their pedicle screws, 8 for their inner bodies, maybe 5 versus 4. And really, this is skewed way out. You really don't see this in other markets. Other health systems our size are not variable, if you will. And this is very, very busy, but I just wanted to show this because these are the different procedures. This doesn't include everything. Otherwise, the slide would be even worse to look at, but we could take our data and look at individual procedures as well. This is what we could share with our surgeons. And for this physician, this is one of my partners, we let him see where he stood. And this is only as it relates to an oblique lateral lumbar fusion, a very expensive procedure, as you can see. There are only, 5 doctors performing this procedure out of the 20. You can see the volume of that they're doing, and you can see their spend and their cost per case. And you can see the variation there. This cost per case can range from almost $19,000 down to $10,000. So if we could squeeze that down and find something in the middle, this would really be beneficial. We looked at how each vendor was utilizing their product with the various surgeons. And this gave us an idea of what vendors were important to what doctors. I think that when I first started this project, I was very fortunate to be mentored by Don Leiter and Adam Campbell. They helped me tremendously with the managing the data. And I'll never forget Don's advice the first day I met him. Are you really sure you want to get into what you're doing here? Have you ever worked? I said, Don, I'm a neurosurgeon. I work with these people. I know what they're like. And, you know, when you start messing with a neurosurgeon's or orthopedic surgeon's pocketbook and you start using words like standardization, they get the feeling like you're about to tell them what to do, and they don't like that. So we knew the best thing to do would be to get quick early wins that were not disruptive and also show them that we're actually here to help them do better. We wanted to show them that with data, good data, we could help enhance their practice and help them out. And that was really key here is this can be a dangerous undertaking, and this is not something that can be done on an individual basis. This required a lot of teamwork. Our surgical VAT team had to work with many other teams within the system. There's a lot of cross-functional teamwork that took place. And I can't tell you, and we can talk about this more later, but how important diversity is. And you just can't put a bunch of neurosurgeons in a room and come out with what you want. It's going to be beneficial to your system or your patients. You really need to stop and listen to some of these key stakeholders that are working in your system in other areas in order for something like this to be successful. But this slide helped us because we knew that we could probably score some early wins without being too disruptive and getting the surgeons on our side. Most importantly, we felt that we could really work to get some potential savings. So if we were at $11 million on our spine spin, if we could go from just below the 50th to the 25th percentile, we could save our system a lot of money. But if we got down to industry low, we could save upwards of $3 million on our annual spine spend. And this is, this potential here, we partnered with a third party called ECRI Institute. They benchmarked our system against 2,000 of their member systems and benchmarked us against healthcare systems that look like we do. And this helped us get an idea just how important this project could be. I actually put this slide in an executive summary, and Norm can share that with you. To our CFO, I gave this to our CFO, and he was very thrilled with this. And this is where we engaged his support significantly. So what we found out at this point was that we had 20 spine surgeons in our 3 adult and 1 pediatric acute care facilities, 31 active vendors spending a little over $11 million per year by our 20 surgeons. 91% of that spend was on bone screws and interbody implants. And we knew that the top 9 vendors represented 84% of what our surgeons were using. And so we knew right away that this could lead to a quick win, which is so important early on in the project. Next slide. So we commenced the pilot project right away, and we immediately cut 60%. We went from 31 vendors down to 9. That was relatively painless and very easy to do. And the surgeons, when they saw the data, they realized, okay, this, when they saw that our system was not up to speed with other health systems and that this was a potential threat to us, when they saw where they stood amongst their peers, they began to buy into this. We identified our top tier vendors because we wanted to start renegotiating contracts. And we told those 9 that we were going to narrow it down even further, and we would be bringing them in for negotiations. And we were going to change the matrix pricing from just below 50%, and we're going to start whittling that down. One of the things that we found out, and I can show you this in a scorecard later, but we had discovered through our data that we had numerous surgical cases that were canceled the day of surgery. And we also found, and this is a little bit embarrassing, 49% of our elective spine cases experienced some type of intraoperative delay. And we thought this was due to a lot of the variation because of all these spine vendors, particularly we were coming out of COVID, and the individuals that we had working in our SPD, in our sterile processing department, they couldn't keep up with all these different trays and all these different vendors, and it was creating chaos. This is another area where we had to quickly change and move with the system. We brought in a specialist, John Winery. He's an expert at process mapping and process improvement. We started studying this in terms of patient safety and quality. And this has become a side project now. It actually prompted a root cause analysis on some things. And we had to make some significant headway on that. And then finally, we wanted to introduce our neurosurgical robotics program to help with standardization and reduce our length of surgery and length of stay. So at this point, we were using a DMAIC model. First, we defined what we wanted to do. That's where we narrowed the scope down and defined what we wanted to get into. We started the measuring process and discovered that data was contaminated. Sometimes it was inaccurate. We had to continually go through and redefine and pull that data out and fine-tune it. And as you can see, we actually found 31 vendors. We found the 20 surgeons. We actually had an increased spend than what we thought. But as we analyzed it, we came up with some key performance indicators that could track and trend. And this was really at the behest of our medical executive quality and safety committee. Another one of the teams that we had to cross-function, we had to work with. And we came up with these KPIs, total cost per case, implant cost, supply cost or variable, length of surgery, length of stay, 30-day readmission, contribution margin. And we decided that we needed to make monthly report outs to key stakeholders. These would be the surgeons, the OR directors, the value analysis team, the MEQ&S, the executive steering committee for all of this, and our chief financial officer and our C-suite. So this is actually an example of the scorecards. This is the executive summary scorecard that goes to our executive steering committee, our senior leadership, and our CFO. And you can show how we trend some of the KPIs he was interested in is our cost per case, our implant cost, our variable or supply costs, and our contribution margin. You can see contribution margin was trending down at this time in 2022. Not a good sign. CFOs don't like that. We wanted to move that needle. But this is a scorecard that went out on a monthly basis. I'll give you an example here. This is a surgeon scorecard. This surgeon's got something like this and then their own individual data. And it showed them the KPIs that they were interested in, their current and prior fiscal year data, their current trending and areas of improvement. And we found this very helpful to get this into their hand. It gave them something to digest, even if they looked at it for 5 seconds. And it really, I think, helped get them to become engaged and aligned with what we were doing. It really helped us get to where we ultimately are today. We really wanted to take advantage of our robotics program. When I first came here, we started this. This was emerging technology. Neurosurgical robots were not on the market even when I came here. When I was at Chapel Hill, we began looking at them as I was the physician champion. That was my project there. So I really wanted to continue that work when I came to Lee Health. So in 2021, we opened up a project charter. This is coming right out of COVID. We started this prior to COVID, but due to the constraints of COVID, we had no capital expenditure. We had to shut it down. Then in January of 2021, we revisited this. We opened up our project charter. This is how we bring new technology into Lee. And again, this involves a lot of cross-functional teamwork with purchasing, procurement, and supply chain, with the medical executive committee, the quality and safety committee, the medical staff, you name it. There were numerous teams that were involved in this project charter. And we looked at every robot that was available. Basically, it was the Medtronic Mazor and the Globus Medical. We ended up going with Globus Medical because they were first to market with a FDA-approved neurosurgical robot. But more importantly, their robot was FDA-approved for both spine and cranial work, which fit our strategic model, our plan that we wanted to do. And also, the robot was mobile. The Medtronic robot, you had to clamp to the bed. It stayed there for the entire case. The mobile robot, we could take from room to room for multiple surgeons to use. So we opened this project up in January 2021, the first case we did in March of 22, about a year later. We were the first neurosurgical robotics case here in our 5-county area. Orlando had ramped up their program, and there were some in Miami that were functioning at the time. But in August of 2021, we became the very first healthcare system in the state of Florida to do a cranial robotics case. And we were only the fourth healthcare system in the United States to perform a cranial robotics case. And then in June of 2022, we had a unique case, and we actually became the very first institution in the state, in the United States, to perform robotics for hemorrhagic stroke. We took the robot, neurosurgical robot, and started leveraging this with our vendor reduction and to improve some of the inefficiencies in our OR and to drive some standardization. Our neurosurgical robotics platform is part of our system-wide robotics program now. And a lot of the data now is being tracked to our analytics center of excellence, so we can easily tap into trends that we're seeing now. We're basically 2 years into our neurosurgical robotics program. We're seeing a dramatic drop in our length of surgery. We have cases that traditionally took 6 hours, dropped down to 1 hour of OR time. And now we're showing length of stay where we can discharge complex spine surgeries the day after surgery, rather than 6 days in the hospital. This is all due to the emerging technology of ultra minimally invasive robotics. We've shown a huge loss of blood loss per case. One of the early spine cases we did was a gentleman came in on our trauma service, not elective surgery, but he fell out of a palm tree and sustained a complete spinal cord injury at T12, had a T12 burst fracture. Had no movement in his legs, no feeling, flaccid rectum, priapism, middle-aged man providing for his family. And here he is, and we're having to plan for an extensive corpectomy, anterior approach, take out a whole vertebrae, very, very complex invasive procedure. You can lose 1 to 2 liters of blood on these cases. That's when he informed us he was Jehovah's Witness, and he could not have product. He could not even have a cell saver and have it reintroduced to him, which really put us in a dilemma. So we used our robot. We did something very clever. We put screws above and below his fracture. We found that his ligaments were still intact. We were able to distract him, reduce his deformity, decompress the spinal cord. He actually made near full recovery and is now ambulatory, has full bowel and bladder function. He's been on the news here recently because of his outcome, and he had no blood loss. And his surgery took maybe 1 hour because of the robot. More importantly, when we introduced the robot, this was competitive with the vendors. We immediately dropped our optimized pricing down to 25% with Globus. This forced Medtronic and the other players into that 25 percentile. And this included both our implants and our variable or disposable costs. More importantly, the data at about 1 year in, now this would have been 2023 after my PEMBA was over, but we saw contribution margin that was 5 times per robotic case compared to a traditional open procedure. That's due to the new technology, by the way. But contribution margin, I think you saw another slide, was about $30,000. It can be as high as $150,000 per case because of this. So that's very attractive to a chief financial officer. And then we're now 2 years in our program, and we still have had no complications, zero infections at this point, and no adverse events from bringing on robotics. So where do we stand here? Now, we're about to have our next quarterly update on our value analysis. And this is data that's going to be presented to senior leadership probably in the middle of April. We are now down to 5 spine vendors. We went from 31 down to 5. And when we went from 9 to 5, we started at the 25th percentile. We are now down to industry low. And we're going to be able to show our senior leadership that we've saved them over $5 million in reduced total costs in the last fiscal year. We have since implemented, we hired a new vice president of surgical services. She has come in. She has worked with John Winery and done some process mapping. Our case cancellations on the day of surgery have really fallen way, way down. And we are not having near the problems with SPD. A lot of it has been due to dropping the vendors from 31 to 5. That has reduced so much variation and confusion in SPD. But more importantly, it's making us more efficient in the OR. We have been able to stabilize workflows, these surgeon workflows and for the surgical techs and the circulating nurses. Everything is prepackaged. When we do a robotics case, it really helps the team move smoothly. And this has really cut down on a lot of the intraoperative delays. We've been able to stabilize, actually improve our contribution margins because of that new technology. 2 of our patients, our stroke patient, she was the first ever. That kind of hit the national news. When the Globus team saw what I was doing, they were wondering, what are you doing? We don't do hemorrhagic stroke. And this lady came in. She had a hemorrhagic stroke being on Coumadin that was required for an artificial heart valve. She had to be on Coumadin. When she first came in, I happened to be on call. I told the team, I said, look, just reverse your Coumadin. That's what we do in these cases. Oh, the cardiologist said, you can't do that. And so she started declining, losing the use of her right side. And the only thing I could offer her was an attempt at something. We modified a workflow for surgical biopsy, and we introduced a catheter through a 2-millimeter hole, evacuated her clot. She made a full recovery. The Globus team sent that up through their legal, and they investigated this, and they have promoted this now as the first actual robotic case for hemorrhagic stroke in the United States. And that's kind of put us on a nice little feather in our head. It positions ourselves as a leader in robotics care. And it's just kind of, I use this to highlight how robotics and emerging technology can help standardize and reduce variation and waste. So with that, I think we got a few minutes left. I want to, some of the lessons I learned in this, I can't tell you the value of how important it is to, as a physician leader, working inside of a team, how the importance of having diversity in your team is so important and being able to listen to them and get their input. You know, some of the other lessons I learned is it might be uncomfortable at first, but getting those quick wins early and getting the surgeons out of the surgeons have a natural inclination to resist change and they're very skeptical. Getting the data in their hands and showing them in a productive way really went a long way in getting them to buy into this. And with that, I'll leave it. I think we got a few minutes for questions and be happy to answer any.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Michael. This was a great presentation. This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. We do have a couple of questions. Don Leiter has joined us on the live stream, and he wondered if you could elaborate a little bit more. You talked about diversity of the team. Just exactly maybe share a little bit more about the composition of your value analysis team and how you decided which people you needed to bring into that team.
Yeah, so our value analysis team includes the OR directors at each acute care facility. It includes the director for procurement, system director for supply chain, system director for contracts. We have a legal representative on there. It's a mixture of male and female, a minority. There are a few doctors on there. It's hard to get doctors to go to these meetings all the time. It cuts into their productivity. Mm-hmm. So in my case, I'm hybrid. I'm part clinician, part executive. But it's very important too to when you start talking about like our robotics, we have a member of that team that's from the robotics program for our system overall. And there are some ambulatory practice directors that are involved in this too. Sure. And it's important to hear what they have to say about access to care and the difficulties that some patients have in getting to see people. It's also important to hear opinions, whether we like them or not, about how we come across as surgeons in treating these people. Because it is important to the patient. It's important to the referring providers. And we get this feedback quite a bit, and it's important to listen to. Because you can get wrapped up in this and just kind of steamroll this project, and it's not going to get you anywhere. Neurosurgeons especially. I've seen this kind of project done in a community hospital where the OR director came in and just said, this is what we're going to do. And it didn't go very well.
No, one of the things that I had thought of as I was listening to your presentation, and Don typed this in the chat too, but you kind of went over fairly quickly sharing the data with your surgeons. And in my experience, that's one of the more challenging aspects. There's always that initial questioning of the data. At least I've had that experience in sharing it, whether it was with emergency physicians or just physicians in general. Well, is that data really accurate? I wonder if you would mind sharing some of your more, this may be the wrong word, but maybe some of your more memorable reactions to when you started sharing the data.
Yeah. So our pilot project kicked off. We had a dinner and we brought in a couple members of the C-suite. The VAT team was there. Supply chain was there, but every spine surgeon was invited. We had a cocktail hour just to kind of calm them down a little bit, get some alcohol in them, kind of loosen them up. We fed them a very nice dinner, and then we gave them the presentation. And as you can imagine, this was the first round of data we pulled out there. And we told them straight up, "Hey, look, this is just the first round of data." Well, they found the contaminated data. And they said, "This isn't true. I can tell you for a fact that, well, you know, we heard their opinions." We said, "Look, this is just the first scrub. We're going to, you know, we went back to them with the next round. And we asked them to show, hey, you showed us this before. Do you see this now? And what do you see?" And they gave us some more stuff. We listened to that. And we were able to drill it down, and we started giving them the blinded results where they stood compared to their peers. And that's kind of a trick from behavioral economics, right? And you show them where they are and what they're missing out on. And that drives them to, hey, I'm going to get in this game a little bit. And once they saw the data cleaned up and where we were going, that helped, that soothed them over quite a bit. And I can go on further. Don asked a question about how do you see artificial intelligence factoring in quite a bit, Don. We actually, and this has nothing to do with spying, but we implemented a AI program on our stroke. And basically when a patient comes in, they get their CAT scan and AI reads it, the CT perfusion, and it will immediately activate our NI team and get the NI lab cranked up for LVO, large vessel occlusion for a thrombectomy. And to highlight that, we had a case come in, a guy came in with a basilar artery occlusion from an acute clot. And the AI program picked it up. That patient was in the lab. His door to catheter time was a mere minutes. The surgeon had that thing pulled out. Guy made a perfect normal recovery. He was actually putting in his note in Epic when the radiology report came back as normal, which if we didn't have AI, that patient would have died. And that's the impact. And where AI could really be in value here is, and I didn't really tap into this, I could have, but those key performance indicators, our analytics team started looking for key correlations. And one of the early ones that came out, as I recall, was, of course, length of surgery correlated directly with the number of implants or your implant costs. Well, it makes sense. If you're doing pediatric scoli cases and you're putting in, 10 plus pedicle screws, those cases are several hours and they're very expensive. And the lesson learned there is when you see AI like that, that can filter through and see correlations that are otherwise hard to see, you learn to start segregating. Well, you know what? Maybe we need to take pediatric scoli out of this as make pediatric and adult deformity its own area and don't throw that in with elective spine. Same like we learned to do a trauma. Some of our length of stay data was horribly skewed because we had trauma patients that were in the hospital so long. And that also skewed our 30-day readmission rates because many of these trauma patients bounce right back to the ER. Mm-hmm. And so we had to use some our analytics team has a lot of that at their disposal. It helps us filter and layer and granulate that data into meaningful data. It takes time. The DMAIC cycle, define, measure, analyze, improve, control. This is continual. This goes mm-hmm. on and on and on, and it doesn't stop. So I think AI is going to be helpful and maybe speeding that up a little bit, kind of identify key correlating indicators that our system can focus in on.
Great. I have one more question before we end because we're almost at the end of our time. But you sure. mentioned the impact on patient experience. You mentioned the impact on OR efficiency. I wonder if you could draw out a little bit more about that aspect of it, how reducing the number of vendors really led to the reduced risk of patient cancellations, delays in the OR, and some of the feedback that you've had from scrub techs, circulating nurses, your anesthesia team members in terms of the impact on their work environment.
Yeah, a lot of our case delays were due to contaminated trays because they were bringing in so many trays, and mm-hmm. the SBD team had to, they would literally get dumps of hundreds of trays the night before surgery that they had to process and get over to us before the next day. They were coming in with what's called a wet load, or there was water inside the tray, mm-hmm. Or they were finding residue. We were finding a strange residue. It prompted a root cause analysis, and it found out there was a chemical in our cleaning solutions that was reacting with the water quality and creating this residue. So once we could figure that out, then that eliminated that problem, right? With the robotics, we're actually hearing from team members now that they, from like scrub techs and circulators, we now have a dedicated group because they want to be there because it's so much easier for them. With robotics, everything is packaged up and much less trays, much less OR time. The case runs smoother. They're in and out quick. They love it. Initially, they didn't want to be on the team. because it was new. But then when they get in there and they experience, hey, this is moving pretty slick here. And it helped buy them in on the technology too. So I know that our cancellation rate is way, way down. That's a different project now that was handed off to our VP of surgical services, and she's done an excellent job on that. We brought to the attention, hey, this is what we found, and they're tackling that problem.
Great. Well, Michael, thank you very, very, very much for taking the time to share your work with us today. This has been very informative. I look forward to having more conversations in the future and
absolutely
seeing if we can kind of get an update in a few years or something about how how you're doing.
Huh. Yeah, well, that sounds good to me. And I want to thank Don Leiter. He was such a great mentor, a big part of this success. He gave me incredible insight during my PIMBA. It's good to catch up with you, my friend.
That wraps up our show for today. Thank you very much for joining and listening to the podcast. If you have any comments or questions regarding this episode, please feel free to add them in the comment section on our website, tiny.utk.edu/podcast. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to the website below. Please also don't forget to subscribe to the podcast by clicking the subscribe button. Add PEMBA On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could leave a review of the podcast on your podcast player. Share the podcast with your friends and colleagues also. Please take good care of yourselves, and as always, good luck with your future.